All right, so we have a few minutes at the end here. So if you've heard anything that maybe sparked a new question or something you want to bring up to the panelists, if you wouldn't mind just making a short line here and speaking into the mic, and we will we'll get your question presented. So anyone, feel free to step up. All right.
Hello. Yeah. All right. Hello, panelists. Hi. Let's see. I actually wrote this down on my card, but I'll kind of ask this in person. What do you guys think of the new parking garages built by all these new student housing developments? Do you think that'll like help decrease traffic in San Marcos or increase traffic in San Marcos? I was just wondering what you guys think of all these big parking garages and stuff.
So just to go into why those are being built is that every time a development occurs in San Marcos, there's a requirement for how much parking is attached to that. And this is very much in the realm of my opinion, but it's literally a tragedy that so much parking is built. You know, the rate of people owning driver's licenses is declining. There's typically, what is it for single, for multifamily? Is it like 1.5?
1.05.
So more, there's more parking being built than there are residents. Is that right? How does that work? Slightly,
so
for a unit?
1.05 spaces per bedroom, depending on what.
So, yeah. And so typically those don't even get filled. Typically, the residents aren't charged for it, so there's no incentive not to bring a car. You're basically making it where it's so much easier to drive than any other mode. Why wouldn't you? It's also incredibly expensive, so you're also making the cost of living much higher than it would be if that wasn't the case. So it also, and then as a ramification of that, because it's so easy to own a car, everyone does it, and then there's much more traffic.
Good summation.
Thank you, guys. That's why I wanted to know if those parking garages actually helped San Marcos or they didn't. It's actually very insightful. Thank you.
Thanks.
Cheers. And if you just tell us your name and if you're a student community member, et cetera.
I'm Gabrielle Moore. I'm a community member. So you brought up the Netherlands a lot and Amsterdam, and I know that they made a big philosophical change several decades ago. They have a different political system than we do, and I know that you brought up political will a lot, which I agree with. We are dealing with generational philosophies, in my experience, and the people who show up. And I'm just going to say it seemed to have a real sense of entitlement. With just feeling entitled to be able to drive to the front door of wherever they need to go and get out and feel put out when they're asked to walk anywhere. And I do agree that we need the political will to push back against that, and showing up is huge. And I agree with you, Andrea, that students should voice where they live and join commissions, et cetera. You could have an outsized voice. But my question is, like, how do we push back in the way that Amsterdam did, for example, with, given our political system?
I don't think it was sort of, they have a whole governmental system that's different, but the way that the citizens in the streets pushed back was very similar to what we can see in the United States. It was really small groups of citizens in multiple cities who actually went into the streets and protested. There are multiple levels of protest. There's actually like taking it to the streets and actually protesting. And then there's the sort of targeted work of having organizations that go out and show up at every meeting. And you can do it both ways. The latter can be more effective than the former. But basically, it started off as we're just not going to take it anymore sort of moment in Amsterdam. And then it still took 2 decades to change. But they kept showing up and they kept having these questions about what to do. And there are places in the United States where you're starting to see that happen as well. So I don't think it's so much a difference between their sort of governmental system and then here. It's just that we need to have that moment where we say we're not going to take it anymore and we want something different. And you know, I come from I usually don't get this advocacy oriented, but you gave me the floor. So you know, I study these movements and how these movements work. And when I start to look at these sort of global trends, you just sort of had, you know, the Extinction Rebellion and then going out in the streets and rethinking climate change. I think there's an opportunity to take that movement and then focus it at the city level, because the decisions that we make in cities are the decisions that basically are spurring the climate crisis. And we need to take the energy from multiple different sectors and bring them together in a constructive way. I don't know exactly how to do that, but I think the seeds are out there for something like that to happen.
Right on.
Hi, my name's Trey. I'm a student staff member. I'm an RA here on campus. I had a question that wasn't specifically regarding San Marcos, but definitely is applicable to Texas as a whole. And my question is, what are y'all's personal opinions on the viability of Texas Central Railway, which is the proposed bullet train between Houston and Dallas, for those who don't know?
It's a great idea. I'm not going to pretend to be an expert on it, but what I have read into it, so for instance, I do know that it's the law in Texas that freight rail has the right-of-way. So if you've ever been on Amtrak and it just goes onto a siding and it just stops, it's typically because there's a freight train trundling by, usually full of gravel or truck frames, and that is given precedence over your trip. And that's why it takes 5 hours to get to Dallas. So, seven. I got lucky then one time. I know that the movement's been gaining, the project to make that happen has been gaining strength. I know that I've read primary source articles saying that were written in the 80s saying it'd be another 20 years, and I know that that's what they're saying now, so.
The private sector is jumping in with this, and the reason that they're having to build a whole new rail system, basically because of the reasons you laid out. But just, again, the political will issue, Morocco just built a high-speed rail. I think we can handle this. This is something we could do if we wanted to do, if we changed our priorities and funded the things that matter. And then there's all sorts of structural reasons why we don't. But it takes changing those big issues sometimes to get it, a high-speed rail network. They're big impediments, and we need focus change to do that.
Hello, my name is Broderick Turner. I'm a student staff member on campus. I guess this is a question specifically for you, Alex. Turning Radii aside and what we're given, what would be the feasibility, or is it a potential thing that there could be a clockwise campus loop implemented?
So I know we talked about it the other day. We looked into it. It's theoretically possible. We think we can do it. From a turning radius perspective. So what we mean by that is literally, can the bus make the turn? And in some cases they can't, so that's a big problem when you're trying to plan a bus route. I do think that there's I would have to just go back to that sort of discussion we had earlier, where do you want to make it clockwise campus loop, you would have to take buses probably from the campus loop, meaning that it would come less frequently. I think that you could probably make it where there would be a campus loop bus at each stop about the same, but instead of being the same route, it would be one would come and then the next would come about at the same frequency. I think that it would be, I would have to think, I'd have to see the schedules and really think about if that would really make sense. But we did look at it.
Hi, my name's Amy and I'm a student here. I think I'm with like the majority of y'all here. It's really important to me to like reduce carbon footprint and like increase walkability and bikeability. But like how when y'all are and like how when we're planning like updates to San Marcos infrastructure, can we make sure that people who are disabled and people living with chronic pain aren't left out of the innovation that we're making in public transit?
Yeah. So there's a policy called Complete Streets, and it was really great to see the sort of Netherlands wonderful Complete Streets method. But when we were planning, we should be planning for everyone. And one of the things that I've seen most recently that was really great is our sidewalk team has been in the downtown area where we've got tons of horrible infrastructure in some of our streets, going in and adding the ramps that are needed, the grades that are needed, filling in our gaps. So we actually got a sidewalk gap program funded several years back, and it's been really great to see those incremental pieces going in and fixing the issues that we already had in some of those areas. But I think in general, it's about planning for everybody. Whether you're riding or walking or in any situation. And so I do think that's important. I think it ties back to how we're looking at designing our streets and retrofitting our streets. And when we're doing work on, let's say, a water line underneath the street, how are we going to take that project when we're already there doing work and putting in the trees, putting in the sidewalks, making sure the grade is ADA accessible, all of those things. So those are really, from my mind, I like to see the incremental pieces going in. If we're already there, we can do a lot if we do it right. Yeah. So.
Yeah. So sidewalks, ADA requirements, just following the guidance that's there. There's great guidance. We just need to do it. It's really interesting when you build a really safe system for walking and biking. You see all different types of people utilizing that system. And one of the things that stands out to me in the Netherlands is I frequently see folks in kind of mobility assist carts utilizing the system. They utilize the cycle tracks and people just out in their neighborhoods. And so that system doubles as a safe system for everybody if you do it right.
And just, I think that those were all excellent points. The only thing I can add is that making it so that city streets are accessible to transit, because you can, just being able to make turns and having the physical right-of-way to put a bus in there doesn't make it a good idea to put a bus route on that street. So for instance, Ocarina isn't a good place to have a bus stop. The feeder road of I-35, we found out, was not a good place to have a bus route. So just thinking about those things when you're making upgrades to streets, what's happened quite a bit, that being upgrades to streets. So for instance, one of the fatalities we had recently in town, there have been three this year, was at Thorpe and Ocarina, which is the site of how many millions of dollars did we spend on Loop 82? Was it 100 million?
We?
Well, the TxDOT. Yeah, mm-hmm. We, the collective we. But it, you know, and so, on this brand new piece of infrastructure, someone was killed, and that's terrible. And it's because the speed limit's 45.
And so the differences in who controls the streets, and the city controls some streets, and then the state controls other streets, and the state is not represented at this table, and it's frequently not represented in safety discussions in a meaningful way. And they could be, but it's frequently really challenging to handle that.
Well, thank you guys so much.
Thanks.
Hello, my name is Kate. I am a student here at Texas State University. The question I had for y'all is, besides like what the city can do and what the university can do to go and to make the roads more accessible for people, not cars, how have y'all encountered ways that businesses essentially have gone and used incentive programs within your line of work to go and encourage people to go and use, not use cars essentially, like for instance, like do they have rewards programs, discount programs that give people a more like direct everyday way to go and see how this benefits them besides like going out and being
publicly active, since we do, like, there are those who are a little bit more, like, they're not very active in going to, like, community meetings, but they will immediately see, like, oh, there's a discount here if I use a bike or something like that.
So Buzzmill did used to have a 10% discount if you rode a bike.
I didn't know that. I'm a transfer.
And then there was also RIP Zuka's, the burrito place that had a 30% discount if you were on the cycling team. So
Dolcetto has one too, but I don't know if everyone can go there. But but so I think from one thing, sort of to your question, is we had a parklet day recently. So kind of connecting it to infrastructure. So businesses in the downtown and actually Main Street is who put it on. Essentially, they took a parking space in front of their business and they got a temporary permit to close that parking space down for a day and turn it into a park. And so we had five businesses participate, and we actually offered sort of a grant. So there's a People's Choice Award that said, hey, if you get the most amount of votes, we'll actually be able to provide you some assistance to potentially try to create one as a permanent infrastructure. And so this is removing a parking space in front of a business, and it was just for a day, but it was able to sort of see how that might be able to spur their business and have people come to their business. And so there's sort of lots of incremental ways to kind of tie that, hey, it's okay, it's not so scary that to remove a space, and it might actually help that business, or the business might actually want it. So that was just an example of sort of a small way.
My name is Bryce Strahan. I'm a student here at Texas State University. I had a question regarding non-bike and non-bus transit. Like, I use VeoRide, the bike system, and I absolutely love it. It helps. It's so easy getting around the city. But I was wondering, what's the feasibility of adding a actual transit system? Because that way you wouldn't have to deal with the buses and you wouldn't have to deal with the cars, as in railed.
Oh. So you're talking about streetcars or light rail or something like that?
Yes.
So personally, I'm a bus guy. I think buses are way more exciting to me than rail. Everyone loves rail. Everyone loves subways. But you know, when a train breaks down, it's a big problem. When a bus breaks down, I just go get another bus. If a route changes, I just change the map. I don't have to dig a bunch of stuff up. From a feasibility standpoint, it'd be kind of probably a 20-year project that would be hugely expensive. Just the infrastructure would probably cost the same as a whole fleet of buses, and I think the last one we bought was $438,000. You're talking about many millions of dollars, so there are definitely some real challenges. I do think there's some cool things you can do with trains, but it would be very difficult.
So an intermediate step too is the bus rapid transit, which basically takes buses, but then build kind of amenities based around that. So you don't get to change your route. But that's also an advantage, because when your route stays the same, all of a sudden people know where it's gonna be and they can build denser land uses around that. And you can create systems like that for far cheaper. I'm a big rail person as well, but that's it takes a real redefinition of funding priorities to get there. The BRT systems, bus rapid transit, are faster and easier to do that, and that's a good intermediate step.
So just to jump back in, you should read some of the articles and the sources out there about how New York built its subways, and it was almost a generational effort, and the subways in London have literally been under construction since the 1860s. And then there's also, have y'all heard of the, oh man.
And again, so as I heard thought.
Right. Do y'all know about the subways in Cincinnati? No, because they built them and then never used them. They're mushroom farms. So there's just a huge amount of effort and labor that goes into it. But not part of your question at all, but I will bring it up. The gold e-bikes for VioRide are launching today as we speak. Yeah, they've been stuck in a purgatory of customs. So you heard it first here. They're launching. What's that? So currently, VioRide is our bike share. We have two kinds of bikes for the bike share. The regular pedal bikes, which is just a analog, or one of my friends said, acoustic bike. just a normal grandma's bike. And then we have the e-bikes, which have a motor in the front wheel, which will assist you when you're riding around. The current e-bikes are teal, which is VioRide's company color. The ones that are about to launch are gold, which is San Marcos's color, which is gonna be kind of cool.
And they're e-bikes.
They are e-assist bikes. Yeah, so when you pedal, the motor cuts in. Kind of cool. So, sorry, but back to your question. Did we answer it?
Or? I feel like we did. I just thought that since the amount of traffic, because I'm a student, I noticed the parking lots here at Texas State are always full. I just thought that maybe a rail system would be able to assist people getting around easier. So, thank you.
Yeah. All right, folks. Thank you all so much for being here. It's been a fascinating discussion. One more round of applause for our panelists. And for yourselves. All right, thanks so much, and we hope to see you again.
This episode was recorded in the Honors College Coffee Forum in Land Passes, sponsored by the Texas State Philosophy Dialogue Series. To find out more information about the Dialogue Series, please visit the Philosophy Department's page of the Texas State University website. There, you can find a calendar of upcoming discussions and a link to other episodes of Philosophy Mix. Thanks again for listening. This has been Philosophy Mixed, a production by KTSW in the Texas State Philosophy Department.